I'm going to start by presenting a conceptual framework for thinking about emotion regulation in the brain. Pretty much made up on the fly, because I don't think there's a whole lot of work out there, except really work by Posner in particular. But it's difficult to find neurobiological accounts of emotion regulation per se. So I think it's pretty much uncharted territory. Some theory and data concerning the development of cortical systems that might be involved in emotion regulation. And then I'm going to spend the second half of the talk introducing a research paradigm for examining cortical activities mediating emotion regulation in children, normal and clinical children, referred for antisocial problems. And I'm going to present some preliminary findings and interpretations, very preliminary. We've only been doing this work for, less than a year. So the findings, we're just getting some data now and starting to make sense of it. So it's all very preliminary. But really, I want to talk about ideas and research directions, research protocols and paradigms and that sort of thing. Okay, so from the point of view of psychology, you can think about emotion regulation in an awful lot of ways. But if you think of cognitive aspects of emotion regulation, I think we can categorize it roughly in something like this kind of a framework. There are cognitive mechanisms for shifting attention toward or away from emotional eliciting events or emotional feelings themselves. And you see this very early in development when little babies can look away from mother, avert gaze, starting at about 4 or 5 months, because they don't like what's going on, it's too stimulating or it's too upsetting or whatever it is. And then we develop, of course, all kinds of more elaborated forms of denial and so forth, including the denial of emotional feelings themselves, which I think is a pretty interesting approach to adults' emotion regulation. So that might be one cognitive system. A second one would be cognitive mechanisms for changing appraisals, obviously toward more pleasant or less stressful interpretations. And we do this by reevaluating, shifting perspectives, elaborating what we know about a situation, and so forth. So, you know, classic example, when your husband or wife comes home with lipstick on their collar, and, I was probably visiting her mother or something, or his mother. Or, you know, this journal never accepts first submissions anyway, so whatever. So we do a lot of this kind of elaborate, cognitive, intelligent rejigging of the characteristics of the situation to adjust the way we feel about that situation. And the third system might be one consisting of cognitive mechanisms for shifting or resetting strategies. These would be strategies, that is to say, action strategies, often for selecting among difficult choices, for action in emotional situations or in emotionally stressful or ambiguous situations. Famously, teenagers have to shun doing bad things and do good things instead because their friends are trying to persuade them otherwise, and so on and so forth. So this kind of shifting of strategies is a very important way of regulating present emotions and future outcomes. And also, there may be mechanisms for shifting self-regulation itself. That is to say, shifting your mode of self-regulation, say from rationalization to self-soothing. When rationalization stops working, say, okay, maybe I'll do this instead. I'll just, you know, be nice to myself or something like that, or somebody else. So I think there's an awful lot of ubiquity to this kind of mechanism. So that's one way of characterizing the view from psychology. The view from neuroscience, well, like I said, there's not a whole lot about emotion regulation per se. When I say that, I mean, I know about, you know, Fox and Davidson and all the rest of it and Posner's work and stuff like that, but sometimes they don't necessarily talk about their work in terms of emotion regulation. Davidson has begun to do that recently, and some other people do. And emotional neuroscientists like Pankseth and people of that sort talk a great deal about emotion systems, but they don't talk about their regulation. So I think we kind of have to chart out this territory. So given that complex cognitive processes are mediated by a prefrontal cortex, there are three executive systems of cognitive control that we can locate there. The first is the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which holds on to information over time, permitting manipulation, synthesis, perspective taking, all that really intelligent stuff that you do with the sort of sides of your prefrontal cortex, which is located roughly there. Okay, that's the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. And second, the orbital frontal cortex, which orients attention and action to present reinforcement contingencies and inhibits responses. So this is the ventral surface, the floor of the prefrontal cortex, right down there. And what it does is it attunes you to the emotional significance of events, both primary and secondary reinforcement properties of events. What's good, what's bad about the world, you get a sudden value evaluation, and you are driven to attend to that and deal with it. And that's mediated by orbital frontal systems. And third is the anterior cingulate cortex, the ACC, which is really going to be the focus of this talk. The anterior cingulate is about there. This is the anterior, the front part of the cingulate cortex, which goes all the way around here at the bottom of the bottom of the medial surface of the cortex, surrounding the corpus callosum, and is densely connected to the limbic system below it or within it, as is some aspect of the orbital frontal cortex. All this purple stuff is densely connected to limbic systems, which is partly why these systems are so important when we're thinking about emotion regulation. So that's where the ACC is, and what it does is it selects among alternative choices or strategies. It selects selects strategies in conflictual situations and judges or does selective attention when there's more than one action which can be taken. So where I want to go with this is just kind of do a rough heuristic and suggest that the first category of cognitive mechanisms of control for shifting attention toward or away from things is probably mediated in large part by orbital frontal systems. The second category, cognitive mechanisms for changing appraisals. This is the intelligent and tricky stuff that we do more as adults than as children, reevaluating, shifting perspective, and so forth. This is probably mediated in large part by the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. And cognitive mechanisms for shifting or resetting strategies are probably mediated in large part by the anterior cingulate. Now, this is, I'm sure, a gross oversimplification. First of all these systems are connected to each other. They're also connected to all other cortical regions and most limbic regions and other subcortical systems as well. So it is a gross simplification, but I think it's a useful way to carve out the map and say, if we can think of different kinds of emotion regulation processes and divide them into neat little categories, we can then start to, you know, link those categories to brain systems, and that can be a useful exercise. Okay, so what about emotion systems in the brain? We've talked about some potentially cognitive regulating systems. What about the emotion systems that they regulate? Well, very briefly, the limbic system, obviously the amygdala is the star player in work on emotion, which is located right here. What that does is attaches emotional significance to stimuli. So that is how we do associative learning to emotional stimuli, emotional learning. We know what's good, what's bad, what's dangerous, what makes us mad, and so forth, immediately, because the amygdala mediates that kind of perception and learning. Next, down the neural hierarchy toward a more primitive structure is the hypothalamus, which controls species-specific behavior routines, drives, as they used to be called, releases neuropeptides and other neurochemicals up to the limbic system in the cortex, which is very important, and controls the autonomic nervous system, which is very important. And then down from there is the brainstem, or inside, in the middle of the brain, is the brainstem, which does all kinds of things. But people focus on brainstem systems like the periaqueductal gray or things of that sort that are very important for emotional behavior, that kind of have little subroutines of flight or fright or flight or fright or freezing or things of that sort that animals do automatically when when they have to behave in a very specific way in the presence of challenge or threat. So we've got these primitive response systems. We also have ascending arousal functions. Okay, so the reticular activating system is housed here, and it sends all these neurochemicals like dopamine and acetylcholine and so forth up to all the other parts, to the limbic system and the cortex, to energize it and to entrain it to whatever is emotionally important, whatever is significant. Helps the cortex to stay tuned to the world in a way that's adaptive. So how might cortical systems actually regulate these emotion functions observed by these subcortical systems? I'm going to my little drawings here, the cortex, there's the limbic system, the hypothalamus, and the brainstem. We would normally think of regulation as being a process of downward modulation or control or hierarchical control or inhibition of lower systems by higher systems. So the hypothalamus controls the brainstem, limbic system controls the hypothalamus, the cortex controls the limbic system, and so forth. So it's like a nice big hierarchy. But it doesn't, it's not that simple. There are reciprocal directions of influence across all of these layers of the neural axis, the neuroaxis. The brainstem tunes and directs the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus tunes and directs the limbic system and energizes the limbic system. The limbic system entrains the cortex, entrains perception to what it sees as significant or important. Motor systems, response tendencies, all that stuff that's cortically mediated is being directed in some sense by limbic structures that are tuned into the immediate emotional relevance of what's going on. So it's a two-way flow of traffic, and I think that's really important. This is often called vertical integration. By vertical integration, what I mean is that when you have a two-way flow of influence like that, what you've got is a feedback loop. And in the brain, of course, you have multiple nested feedback loops. And guess what feedback loops do when you get them going? They self-organize. Feedback loops self-organize. So you get a flow of activity among all of these systems flowing back to themselves so that they become synchronized and fall into a coherent pattern very rapidly in real time. This is, I think, a really neat idea and one I can't get into too much in this talk because I don't want to go too theoretical, but it's something that I've been pursuing in recent work and I've been inspired by people like Walter Freeman in thinking about this stuff. So one of the neat implications, I think, is that emotion regulation isn't just this top-down process. It can be thought of as being embedded in a rapid cascade of effects moving up and down the neuroaxis, leading to synchronization and coherence, a unified brain. We've got a book called Emotion, Development, and Self-Organization, and Walter Freeman has a chapter in that book, which I just love, and he talks about how the brain just goes shunk whenever it's being emotional. You know, you can be daydreaming and having a reverie most of the time, but as soon as you are having an emotion, as it were, or an emotion is rising in intensity, suddenly all those systems become coordinated, and now you're just doing one thing. You're working on what's important. So in Freeman's words, this leads to the self-organization of the entire brain. This is a continuing process that continues to go on in real time. Another way of representing this kind of synchronization is, here's another sketch, the orbital frontal cortex and the anterior cingulate, these two prefrontal systems that have connections back to a lot of posterior and other parts of the cortex. The anterior cingulate cortex has bidirectional traffic with the amygdala. The amygdala sends has innervation down to the brainstem through the hypothalamus. The brainstem sends its neurochemicals back up to the cortex. So all these systems become synchronized together through this multi-directional neurochemical traffic. Okay, it all becomes unified and synchronized. Well, okay, so that's a theoretical perspective that I just think is useful. Now I want to talk more specifically about development. In reading developmental neuroscience, well, there's nothing that I can see about emotion per se or emotion regulation really, except for Posner's work. And even Posner's work is not, in a sense, they've gone further with their attentional tasks than they have with actually measuring what changes in the brain that they think might underpin some of the developments that they're interested in. But here is a rough look at the maturation of the three prefrontal systems that I've talked about. The first, the orbital frontal cortex, matures early, starts to mature very early in infancy, allowing for the evaluation of maternal behavior and the formation of attachment styles. A lot of this work is reviewed by Alan Shore and a whole bunch of books and papers and so forth, and he does a great job of putting it together. The idea is that your orbital frontal cortex is ready to attach value or significance to whatever's in front of your face. For babies, this is very important. Their mother's voice and face and posture and cues have to be attended to. So attention is entrained to this, and mother is evaluated as a, quote, reinforcing or non-reinforcing entity, if you've used that kind of language. And there you go. And then you can, you know, develop a particular attachment style with this caregiver. The anterior cingulate also matures continuously from infancy. But there appears to be, or that's hypothesized to be, a growth spurt in anterior cingulate function responsible for the onset of effortful control. And this is this concept by Posner and Rothbart, effortful control means the capacity for 4-year-olds to control their impulses in a nutshell. So one of the experiments that looks at this is the investigator will say, I'm going to give you this really neat present, and you can open it up as soon as I come back into the room. 3-year-olds are incapable of waiting. But 4-year-olds can do it. They sit on their hands, sometimes literally, and they wait, and that's called effortful control. That's basic emotion regulation. That's regulating your emotions. And they attach this advance to the anterior cingulate system, to maturation and development of that system. Third system, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, connections mature most slowly, continuing into early adulthood, but consolidation is particularly rapid during adolescence. Okay, so that's what people think anyway, and you know, it's a lot of this we don't know for sure, but there appears to be consolidation of various sorts, including synaptic pruning throughout adolescence, such that adolescence is a period of immense flexibility early on, and this consolidation then, if you like, kind of sculpts a particular response style or way of dealing with emotional, interpersonal situations and so forth, which become crystallized over the years of adolescence. At least that's the idea. I went to this conference last month on adolescent brain development. The consensus was that we don't know much, but much of what we do know points to the fact that there is this period of flexibility in pre-adolescence, followed by a period of consolidation following it. And a lot of this is attributed to dorsolateral prefrontal cortex and other prefrontal systems. Okay, so I'm going to show you a movie now. This is a very cool movie that we got wind of at this conference. It's an 8-second movie. And this 8-second movie will show you about, will look at the changes in the thickness of the cortical mantle from the age of 4 to 21 years. Okay? So it's an 8-second movie, so you have to watch carefully. I can play it again, though, and I will. But what happens, actually, is perhaps counterintuitively, the cortical mantle thins with development. That thinning is thought to represent consolidation and synaptic pruning. So by looking at the rate at which thinning occurs in different regions of the cortex, what you can see is the rate at which different cortical systems become efficient, lose their extraneous synapses, become you know, basically wired for life. Here it goes. Okay, that was 4 to 21 years. Let me tell you what the color scale means. The blue-purple end of the scale is toward the thinning end, whereas the red-purple scale is the thickness end. So things will start off redder or possibly greener and move toward the blue and purple zone as they thin out. I'll say it again. What you should be seeing is that you get consolidation here in this orbital frontal region very early, whereas you get consolidation in the dorsolateral prefrontal region very late. This comes in latest. You also get consolidation here in the sensory motor strip very early because, hey, kids need to be able to, you know, walk and talk and do stuff and be aware of their bodies long before they really have to know how to think, luckily. So you'll see the bluing will happen there very rapidly as well. I just think that's fast. I could watch that all day. Here's the top view. There's the front. So what we're going to see is consolidation, thinning starts there and moves forward into the lateral prefrontal cortex with time. Say it once more at each of those scales. So you see this region here is the last to mature. Unfortunately, we can't see the anterior cingulate because it's wedged in there. But presumably it matures quite quickly compared to the dorsolateral prefrontal system. Okay? So Now, let's look in more detail at the adolescent transition, because it's something which has been studied. It's thought that massive pruning begins to take place in prefrontal systems, as I said, supporting the development of working memory, voluntary inhibition, preparatory sets for anticipated action in order to support context-sensitive behavior. This is what teenagers are supposed to learn, context-sensitive behavior. And I'm going to talk about a study which compares kids with adolescents with adults in this task, which is a very neat task called an anti-saccade task. In this task, what you have to do is you have to look away from a light that is flashed on one side of your visual field. So they put these subjects in a scanner, and they tell them to look at a fixation point, and then they flash a light on one side or the other of the fixation point, and you're not supposed to look at the light, you're supposed to look in the opposite direction. This is extremely difficult, because it's obviously intuitive to look toward the light. So you really have to exert a lot of voluntary effort, a lot of voluntary control. Here's the neural results for these three age groups. The top bar is showing anterior cingulate activity. There is a little bit in kids, there's a lot in adolescents, and there's less in adults. That roughly parallels dorsolateral prefrontal activity. There's very little in 8 to 13-year-olds. There's a lot in adolescents, and then there's less in adults. What we're seeing is that for the adolescent group, both the anterior cingulate and the dorsolateral cortex to which it's connected are both seeming to light up the most at the during those years of adolescence, as though those kids somehow have to do something special to do this task. I think the implications for self-regulation or cognitive control might be the following. Anterior cingulate activation may be greatest when children are working hardest to select or control their responses. And that's an important point. In order to make that kind of effortful decision-making, selecting when there's a difficult choice, when there's response conflict, might require a particular kind of effort that might be subserved by anterior cingulate activity. This is something which these results suggest. See, in Luna, in presenting this stuff, she also talked about how, you know, adults would get the task quite quickly, but teenagers would have to work at it trial after trial, and they would get it more gradually. So you could really kind of see it as an act of of extreme effort. Secondly, anterior cingulate activation may be coupled with dorsolateral prefrontal activation differently at different developmental phases. Just leave that on the table. Okay, so that's pretty much the theoretical part. Now I want to talk about our research program, which, as I say, is just beginning. The purpose of the research that we're doing is to assess developmental change and individual differences in frontal cortical functions responsible for emotion regulation. And we're doing this with ERP technology, using an emotion induction task that we've developed. I'm going to explain more about ERPs in a minute for those of you not familiar with it. We do this with normal children of all ages, and we're doing it also with antisocial youth before and after treatment. Obviously, we're interested in part, as I know Kurt is, about the parallels between developmental change and change with treatment. You know, treatment is an interesting kind of experiment in development, you might say. Who said that? Somebody said that. Okay, so the problem of self-regulation, to put it that way. Both younger children and antisocial youth may have difficulty regulating negative emotions, including anger and anxiety. Anxiety often gives way to anger, by the way, so antisocial kids are often not just angry, they're also really anxious, and that's often why they blow up. Poor affect regulation may reflect less developed synchronization among prefrontal control systems. I'm just putting that out as a working hypothesis. We can discuss it at the end of the talk. Less developed synchronization. Not that one region or another is less developed per se, but less developed synchronization among those regions. Leading to inadequate monitoring of one's own actions, failure to focus on alternative appraisals or strategies, failure to disengage from distressing cues, difficulty inhibiting impulses. These are all perfectly normal things for young kids, right? And we expect them and we don't think anything of them. They can't monitor their own actions very well. They can't focus on alternative appraisals. They're very context-bound. They can't disengage from distressing cues. They cry for long periods of time sometimes. I remember when my daughter got a pink horse when she was three. My stepson, who was six at the time, wanted that horse so badly, and he couldn't stop thinking about it, and he would cry and demand and carry on and manipulate and do everything in his power for hours and hours and hours because of a little tiny plastic horse that she'd won at a fair. Could not disengage from that. He's a little better now that he's 18. So these are good things in kids, but they're maybe not such good things in older kids, and therefore these are some of the problems that we see in kids that have behavior problems, antisocial behavior problems. Okay, so let's talk about ERPs. ERP stands for event-related potential, and this technology has been around for a long, long time, although it's now taken some pretty rapid advances with dense array technology, which I'll be talking about. What the idea is, this is a recording of the electrical activity of some region of cortex, which is a continuous electrical wave which goes up and down in voltage. But you can take that wave and you could subdivide it by events. So there's red events and yellow events and white events. And then you can average for each of those events and get an averaged waveform for each of those types of events. They could be different kinds of trials in an experiment or what have you. And then you have several averaged waveforms which you can compare with each other. And that's how you get this kind of classic ERP image of things going up and having little bumps and hoops and troughs where they're supposed to, and there's lots and lots of books about what those troughs and peaks mean. And they've been studied, as I say, for decades, so people have a very good idea about what some of them mean, not all of them. And also, they're all sort of coming under question nowadays, it seems. People are starting to talk about ERPs as being the synchronization of brainwaves, which I think is an absolutely fascinating new topic. Synchronization or resetting of brainwaves. Here, this might be, you know, a multi-channel system. Here are a bunch of channels which reflect electrodes that are close to each other on the head are picking up the same change in voltage. Okay? And that's going to be highest at one electrode, but it's also going to also be picked up a little bit less at neighboring electrodes, indicating that there's a lot of activity going on in that underneath that region of scalp. Although that's also an oversimplification. Cognitive ERPs are ERPs that occur later. That is to say, in the first 150 milliseconds or so, the parts of the ERP waveform are thought to be to tap perceptual functions. But after that, 200 to 400 milliseconds after an event, that's when cognition kicks in. Now your information is being modulated by prefrontal regions. It takes a while to get there and to start to think about things. But the classic P300 that you've probably heard about is thought to be a cognitive ERP. It has to do with recognizing an important event. So I want to suggest that cognitive ERPs might be a way to tap emotion regulation, because cognitive ERPs tap cognitive responses to events. And so for emotional events, I'm suggesting that these responses may be intrinsically regulating. What is a cognitive response, after all? It's a cognitive response to something. And if there's emotional problems that need to be solved going on, then that cognitive response could be thought of as needing to deal with that emotional situation, not just a pure cognitive response. So this might be a way to think about how to use ERP research for looking at emotion regulation. So I'm suggesting that cognitive ERPs may display differences, such as differences in amplitude, when subjects are regulating their emotions. And it's this idea that we're basing our research program on these days. We're taking somewhat familiar cognitive ERPs and injecting emotion into the situations that elicit them to see if those ERPs change with an emotion induction situation. By the way, my wife suggested that when I practiced this talk yesterday, I made up this talk 2 days ago, actually. I don't know why I keep doing this, but I seem content to use the same talk twice. It's a great deal of extra work, but it's what I'm excited about now. But she said I should suggest to people that positive and negative don't have anything to do with value. They're voltages. Okay. So an electrical current fluctuates, and that fluctuation can be seen as having around a baseline of zero in a positive or negative direction, positive or negative voltage. Those directions are somewhat arbitrary for the purposes of this talk. Okay, so what kinds of ERPs are produced by the anterior cingulate cortex? Well, just to review, the anterior cingulate cortex is thought to be responsible for response selection, action monitoring, error detection, choosing between competing strategies. A lot of this is worked by Van Veen and Carter, Falkenstein, Neuenhuis, Liu and Tucker, people of that sort. Processing motivational information and perhaps regulating emotional responses, although that isn't talked about too much. Liu and Tucker and colleagues stress its role in self-regulation. That's what they talk about, is the kind of generic term for what the ACC does. And Posner and colleagues emphasize its role in effortful control, as I mentioned. Okay, so now I'm going to mention three ERPs that are thought to tap ACC function. The first is called the error-related negativity, or ERN. It's a sharp negative deflection, which generally occurs 50 to 150 milliseconds following an error response or response conflict. What that means, the reason it's called an error-related negativity, because you've got this thing on your head and recording your brain waves, and you're pressing a button, and sometimes you press it wrong. You're supposed to press the right button and you press the left one or something like that, or you're supposed to withhold but you press instead. That's an error. You know you've made the error actually just before your finger hits the button. So this deflection here is really produced before the response, before your finger hits the button, as your brain, in a sense, wakes up and says, uh-oh. In fact, it's been characterized as an oops response. Okay, so that's the oops ERP. The second one, the error positivity, PE, is a second positive deflection following an error response again. So it's part of the same waveform, but it's this part here rather than this part. When the subject is concerned about the error. This is hypothetical, I should say. Nobody really knows what the PE represents or stands for, but people think that it might be a more affective response to the error, like a concern about having made an error or a self-reflection about it. Or I think of it as an oh my God response. That's because I am, you know, dispositionally anxious. So that's how I would do it. So that's the second one. The third one is, or used to be called, the no-go N2. It's a negative deflection which occurs 250 to 400 milliseconds or so following a stimulus, flocked to the stimulus rather than the response, when effortful discrimination is required or selecting among competing responses. Sound familiar? This is about discerning difficult choices or making choices when there is some conflict between response tendencies. Here's the stimulus, and here's the no-go N2. And this is found when you are engaged in a task and you don't make a mistake. It's particularly found in trials where you're successfully inhibiting the mistake. So some authors are suggesting that what this is the same kind of anterior cingulate conflict monitoring function working before the mistake rather than after the mistake, which is probably, you know, a good idea in social situations and so forth. You always say oops after you've said the wrong thing, but it's better to catch it before you say the wrong thing. So this could be a kind of just say no response. Okay, so those are the three ERPs. And something about what their presumed cognitive operations that they tap. Here is something I also borrowed from Sid Segalowitz. These are correct trials on the black line. These are error trials on the red line. So I've never had anything quite this clear, but see a nice negative deflection on error trials and a nice positive deflection on error trials as well. That would be the ERN. This would be the PE. Okay? But you don't see it, or you don't see it as much on correct trials. Also, and this is very important, the ERN and the N2 have both been related to personality or clinical typologies. They've been studied in relation to antisocial adults, although not antisocial youth, at least not until now. And obsessive compulsive, at least some work on obsessive compulsive adults. What they're finding is that obsessive compulsives, who are presumably more anxious and more concerned about their responses, are having much greater deflections in their ERNs, the greater negative deflection, greater amplitude suggesting there might be increased activation of that anterior cingulate region when they're involved in this difficult task. Okay, so we're going to get back to that idea soon. Now I'm going to tell you about our task. I'm quite proud of this task. Been working on it for some time. The nice thing about doing, you know, ERP stuff instead of like developmental psychology is that it takes you an awfully long time to develop a task, but once you've developed it properly, then you just collect some data and there it is. And you put it on your computer and you put it in SPSS pretty soon. Whereas in behavioral approaches to development, what you have to do is you have to code it. And that, as far as I know, takes years. Never been able to do it in less than years. I hate coding. So this is one thing. Once the task is ready, the rest is. But it's difficult to get the task ready. Children are brought into the lab by their parents. And this EGI, Electrical Geodesics 128 channel sensor net, is applied while the child is seated in front of the computer monitor. It looks like this. It makes children very happy, as you can see, to have this thing applied. It's, obviously, this is an ad from EGI, but it's a very neat thing because all the electrodes are little sponges and they're damp, and the sponges are the only thing that contact the person's head. So there's no metal on their head. In the old days, like a few years ago, they used to actually abrade the scalp and paste metal electrodes onto the scalp. So the EGI folks claim this is no longer necessary. This thing is like a hairnet which holds all these things in place. You fit it all onto the head of a piece, and then you fiddle with it for about 10 minutes. And once all the sponges are standing up properly, then you can go ahead with the experiment. In this study, EEG data are recorded while the child performs a 15-minute go-no-go computer task. And I'll tell you about that in a minute. The goal, they're told, is to obtain sufficient points to win the big prize. And they come in and they see these two bins of toys. One bin is got really crummy toys, like, I don't know what they are, little rubber spiders or something. And the other bin has really great toys, like, you know, things that spin around and give off light and sound, or action figures or things of that sort, or gift certificates for HMV for older kids. Do you have HMV here? Okay. For older kids and so forth. Those are the good toys and things that you want to win. So kids can see that there's some value to getting a lot of points. The child is instructed to press a button or withhold response as cued by letters displayed on the screen, and the task is divided into three blocks, preceded by a practice block. So I'm going to now show you how this works. It's a go-no-go task, which means when you see a stimulus, you're either supposed to press the button or withhold the button press. You either go or you don't go. That's it. It's very simple. And the instruction is withhold your response, don't press, when you see two letters in a row. So the second of two letters, withhold. It's very simple, but it's very hard. So here's an X, go. Y, go. X, go. Another X, wait. That's all. But when these things are coming at you once every second or once every second and a half, you know, you just press the button. This is how you get the error-related negativity, because we, you know, produces a fair number of errors. And what we've done, we show them their points every once in a while, and we show them a red bar when they make a mistake, either a mistake of commission, so they hit the button when they're not supposed to, or a mistake of omission because they've waited too long and the window's gone by. This is why they have to hurry. Now, this is the neat part. The timing of the stimulus is dynamically adjusted to maintain an error rate of close to 50%. So if they're doing quite well, then it gets faster. And if they're starting to make more mistakes, it goes slower. So what that does is it keeps the response, the error rate, at about 50%. And the purpose of that is that we get about, ideally, half ERNs, error-related negativities, and half no-go N2s when they successfully inhibit. So we can get a sufficient number of both kinds of responses. So it took us a long time to develop that, but it's fun. And then your points are displayed on the screen every 20 trials or so, a total of about 500 trials. And this is the other part of the task that's important. The first trial block, there's a low penalty for error, so there's a buildup of points. In other words, you're getting more and more points, you're seeing your points on the screen, you're feeling good about life, and you get up to 1,000 or more, 1,500 points. But the second block, now the algorithm changes, and now there is a high penalty for errors. Now the points drop off, even though it's the same error rate. You see your points start to go down, and they actually go down to zero. So by this point, the kids, all their points have disappeared. So this is obviously an emotion induction paradigm. This induces and seems to induce anxiety, strangely enough. We are testing our kids and asking them what they're feeling and so forth, and we're probably going to analyze the videotapes of their faces and bodies, but you can just obviously tell. They think, oh, shit, oh, no. So they're definitely getting anxious when they lose all those points. And then in the C block, it goes back to the easier condition. Now they can build up their points, but they're probably still more vigilant and more concerned. This is the electrode array of a 128-channel system. You know, an awful lot of electrodes. This represents the electrodes that sit all over the scalp, some in the face, some right on the back of the head, and so forth. This is where ERP has gone. It used to be like three electrodes. And in fact, we're using three electrodes to do our statistical analyses, these three here, or the waveforms that I'll show you in a few minutes. These are kind of plastic locations where you see these particular ERPs, or where they appear to be maximal. The developmental results I'll go through first, and then I'll talk about individual differences. We have, so far, 42 normal kids. We've divided them into five to 9-year-olds, 10 to 12-year-olds, and 13 to 16-year-olds to get just reasonable age brackets and reasonable numbers in each cell and so forth. It's not rocket science at this point. And, well, here's the results. Here's the youngest group, the 5 to 9-year-olds, the middle group, the 10 to 12-year-olds, and the youngest group, the 13 to 16-year-olds. Here's the ERN, or the OOPS response. As far as I can tell, this is just mush. It doesn't look very interesting to me. There's very little age difference, and I have no way of explaining why that is so low. Okay, so that's not very nice, but this one's better. Here's the error positivity, the oh my God response. What you can see is that it is goes up a little bit in the middle age, but drop a lot between the 10 to 12-year-olds and the early adolescents. And that is actually a significant effect. So there's a decrease with age. What also, the other part that's interesting here is that there's not a huge difference. Well, there's some difference here, but between blocks. But the difference between blocks is most pronounced for the older kids. Okay, so their amplitude in the B block is about, well, over twice their amplitude in the A block. And that continues to be high in the C block. What that means is that their ACC is not as active in the A block prior to the emotion induction. But when the points start to drop and they presumably get anxious, their component becomes much stronger, implying more activity in that system. Okay, so it seems to become more differentiated with age. We see this again in the no-go N2. Very much the same pattern, actually even clearer. Again, there's a drop with development. The amplitude, this is like -7 microvolts, and it goes down, this is -1 microvolts. There is a drop in amplitude with age, but there's an increase in sensitivity with age, so that the oldest group is seeming to respond with almost 3 times the amplitude in the emotion induction condition, and continuing in the C block as well. But they're just not as impressed with the A block, or their ACC is not as impressed with the A block. Okay, so those are some developmental findings, preliminary ones. I'm going to review this in a sec. Let me just show you some of the goodies here. This is what the waveform looks like. This is for the oldest age group. This is a kind of classic thing. Here, oh, I forgot to fill in the color key, sorry. Blue is A, red is B, and yellow is C. So what this is the no-go N2 right here, and it's showing that there is an increase in amplitude from A to B to C. These waveforms are slightly misleading because of that averaging issue that I was mentioning before. You really have to, this is a grand average made over 9 kids, and what you have to do is take each kid and count up their waveforms, or at least get their average waveforms within each block, and do your stats on those numbers rather than on these grand averages, which can be misleading. Okay, here's some other nifty depictions. Here's scalp maps. These are showing the blue color is frequency is negative voltage, the red color is positive voltage. What you're seeing here is a great big blue vortex of current right on top of approximately the area of the ACC. And you see it in block B, you don't see it in block A, and it's even a little bit stronger in block C. Okay, so the intensity of the color tells you something about the actual voltage measured at the scalp. And obviously these contour lines tell you about the region at which it's measured. With 128 electrodes, you can do that. You can get a map of the whole scalp, and that's one of the things that's very good about them. But what's even better is that you can do source analysis. This is actually why I wanted to get into this stuff, because source analysis seemed like so much fun. With source analysis, you can take this scalp map and you can convert it into a model of what's going on inside the cortex. This is a program called BISA, which is used by a lot of investigators, and it's a very, very fancy and sophisticated program. And what it does is it takes this pattern of voltages at the scalp, and it derives models. It basically says, okay, if I were an electrical source anywhere in the brain, would I be producing this pattern? And it tries that electrical source everywhere in the cortex, and it finds the spot which best produces that pattern, or which produces a pattern most like that at the scalp. It's a bit like factor analysis, because once you've nailed that electrical source, then you say, okay, what else is left that this source can't account for? And then you look for another source. And you compile a number of sources in the brain, which are hypothetical regions from which the activity is coming from, the activity that's responsible for the scalp pattern that you've recorded. Is that a clear idea? Any questions about that? It's kind of a leap. It's actually of modeling what's going on inside the cortex, and there's some controversy about it, but a lot of top investigators are using it these days. So I think, you know, it's certainly good enough for me. It's good enough for them. Okay, so this is an MRI scan of an N2. I believe it's an N2, or it could be an ARN. I can't remember which. By Botvinnik, Carter, and colleagues. And this shows you the actual location of activity in the anterior cingulate, as shown on an MRI. I don't remember the nature of the task, but this is where we want to find our source. Okay, we find these scalp pictures, we've measured them, we've got our statistics and so forth, but we're really hoping that all this activity is actually coming from the anterior cingulate. And miraculously, it actually was. There's a two-source model, and that's one of the sources. And there it is from the top view. Here it is from the sagittal view or the side view. That's almost exactly where you want it to be. This is an MRI head. It's a generic head. So the placement of the source isn't perfect, but it's certainly in the right region. From the top view, you can see that this is pretty medial, pretty close to the midline, maybe not close enough. It's certainly on the right rather than the left. I don't know why it might be right anterior cingulate rather than left anterior cingulate, but that's what we seem to be finding. And anyway, when my postdoc actually completed this analysis 2 days ago, I was amazed that it came out right. It's quite a number of steps you have to go through to get here. Okay, so it does look like we're picking up ACC activation. Now I want to talk about internalizers versus non-internalizers within the sample. What we did was we took the CBCL, the child behavior checklist, and we gave it to all these kids. And it's not a great instrument for normal populations, but what we did was we took raw scores of 10 or above and called those internalizers. Sorry, raw scores on the internalizing subscale, which is a compound of a lot of elements that basically tap anxiety and depression and things of that sort. So raw scores of 10 or above, we call them internalizers. 9 and below, we call them non-internalizers. We wanted to just compare these subgroups within our sample. What we found for the ERN was that it's not significant, but there's a whole lot more amplitude for the internalizers than for the non-internalizers. And it happens in the B block. That's when it comes on. So this is when, if you want to assume that there's something about anxiety which is responsible for this effect, it does indeed seem to be picked up by that emotion induction block when they're starting to lose their points. And there's a major oops going on. Notice that that's consistent with the findings about the OCD people. Higher amplitudes for more nervous people. Okay, so there's the ERN results for the... Here's the PE, error positivity results. Now we're getting closer to significance, where P equals 0.1, but 0.16 controlling for age. But, you know, the means are really quite different. These internalizers, I don't know why they're going down, though. I can't imagine why they're going down with block. It would seem to me that, like the ERN, they should go up in the B block and stay up. I don't know why they're going down. One possibility is that they're becoming... that the initial impact of the error is greater, but once you've been doing the task for a while, you reflect on it less a few hundred milliseconds later. But this is obviously fishing for an explanation. We controlled for age because we're using raw scores and so forth, but there is something to the main effect as well, and because we are actually interested in self-regulation. And that is partially across age and partially an individual difference factor. But it is important to control for age. Finally, with the no-go N2s, much better effect, P equals 0.02. Finally, we got significance for the main effect, 0.08 controlling for age. But this is a huge difference. You can see that the internalizers are getting a much higher amplitude response on all blocks. On all blocks, again, I wish it weren't so. I wish they got it especially on the B and C blocks, but there you go. Okay, summary and interpretation. For 2 out of 3 components, amplitudes decreased with age. For 2 out of 3 components, amplitudes became more differentiated by block with age. This may suggest that demands on ACC function are greater for younger children, but older children ramp up ACC activity to cope with anxiety or stress. So that's my working hypothesis right now. Internalizers also showed higher amplitude components, higher means for all, only one significant. This may suggest that internalizers have their ACC on overdrive. They may often be in a state of high effortful control to regulate their anxiety. So that's as far as we've come in interpreting these results. I'm not going to tell you about the antisocial kids, but I think what's interesting here is that it looks like kids who internalize more are behaving more like younger children. Okay, and this is something Jerry Patterson said years ago, I don't know when, that aggressive 8-year-olds look like normal 3-year-olds behaviorally. So this is a kind of generic developmental, I know it's not... Yes, they would. But externalizing and internalizing are often highly correlated. I've been discovering this, right? I'm sure you have, right? And a lot of kids are comorbid for both. So I think you're seeing a lot of both. But yeah, that we also went in thinking that the world should be a simpler place. So it's possible that older kids who are internalizers are in fact looking more like younger kids in their emotion regulation function. They're demanding more of their ACC. They're making it work harder for what they get in terms of emotion regulation. Okay, now briefly I'll just go over, this is a pilot study. Participants were clinically referred boys between 6 and 12 years of age. We only have 8 in this particular analysis. Age match controls, these are age match boys, and of 11. The clinical group was referred for antisocial behavior problems. Note, externalizers are often comorbid for internalizing problems. In fact, 5 out of 8 of these children had internalizing T-scores of 60 or above. 65 is borderline. So we went in, Kurt, also, yeah, thinking that they were going to, you know, I mean, show very different sorts of results. And then we went back and looked at their internalizing scores to try to make sense of what we found. Okay, here's the waveforms. This is the no-go N2. All I want you to look at here, this is the right electrode for the maximal peak. The clinical kids are showing just messier waves. There's much more variation in this sample. You see that even more with the error-related negativity and error positivity. It's a lot more messy for those kids. A lot of variation, a lot of heterogeneity in that sample. Here's some scalp maps that I don't need to go into. And here's the results. for the error-related negativity, the oops response, we get much higher amplitudes for the clinical kids, especially in the B block. Okay, again, our 0.07. For the error positivity, again, not much, but higher amplitude for clinical kids, especially in the B block. Also approaching significance. And same thing for the no-go N2, exactly the same thing, although it's not significant, so we don't know which way it's going to go with more kids. But you are seeing at least the means are higher for the clinical kids, higher amplitude responses for the clinical kids. So these kids are looking like what our internalizers look like in the normal population. They're getting higher amplitudes on some or all of these ACC components. And what I want to show you is what I think is an enticing correlation. I would never want anyone to quote me on this because it's such a tiny sample so far, but take a look at that scatter plot. This is an R of 0.82 between the internalizing T-score on the CBCL and the amplitude of the error positivity in the B block. Okay, that's just an amazing scatter plot. I mean, it's hard to get 0.82 by accident, right? So I'm sure that won't stay that high, but with more kids. Notice that the clinical kids, all these red dots, are at the high end of the scale, most of them in internalizing, but the one kid who is very low on internalizing is also very low in his error positivity, suggesting that this is a real meaningful correlation. And you know why this is so intriguing to me is this is a correlation between what a mother or teacher wrote on a questionnaire about behavior problems with amplitudes of brain activity. That's a correlation between brain and behavior. You know. Exciting. Okay, so summary of these preliminary findings. Group and block differences. Clinical children showed greater amplitudes for all three components, approaching statistical significance for the PE and ERN. Amplitudes for both groups rose in block B and or C. Correlations with CBCL scores. As I said, most notable, which was a high correlation between internalizing scores and the error positivity, the PE, for both groups, but particularly for the clinical group. Okay, so I'll conclude tentatively with these thoughts. ERPs thought to tap the anterior cingulate function change with development and vary with personality clinical subtypes, what we seem to be finding. Development seems to be characterized by a reduction in ERP amplitudes, yet greater specificity to emotion induction conditions. Internalizing styles in normal and referred children correspond with higher ERP amplitudes that are often sensitive to emotion induction conditions. Both younger children and more anxious children, so here's the tentative interpretation, both younger children and more anxious children, and these referred children, may have to recruit greater ACC activity and perhaps work harder to regulate negative emotions. So this is what I want to leave you with. This particular emotion regulation mechanism that sits somewhere in there, to speak somewhat metaphorically, may have to work particularly hard for kids who are younger and for kids who are having social problems. Whereas when you get older, or if you don't have those kinds of problems because you've had a different kind of life and you've been able to have a much more regulating environment, you don't have to use this kind of online system to vigilantly control your responses. Rather, you can do it in a more contextually sensitive way using other systems, perhaps, for more synchronization across those systems. And again, Patterson, behaviorally, aggressive 8-year-olds look more like normal 3-year-olds. A similar principle may hold for cortical functions.